Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Michigan, the critical state which Obama's campaign adviser David Axelrod has vowed if they lose, he will shave off his moustache. The former governor of Michigan, Jennifer Granholm, joins us to discuss the willfully dishonest ads the Romney campaign are running, claiming Detroit is moving production to China, which have prompted angry denials from the heads of GM and Chrysler. Governor Granholm has an article at the Huffington Post, "Ohioans won't be fooled by car guys' desperate car lies." Then we will speak with an insurance expert, Jeffrey Stempel, professor of law at the University of Nevada's Las Vegas School of Law, where he teaches insurance law. We will discuss the growing losses insurers are experiencing from monster storms like Andrew, Katrina, Irene, and now Sandy, and how much Wall Street, which was just flooded, and the insurance giants will recognize the economic reality of global warming and push back against the deniers funded by big oil and coal. Then finally, we will speak with Jeff Cohen, the founder of the media watch group FAIR and the co-founder of RootsAction.org, who have launched a safe state, swing states voting strategy to enable progressives to signal their displeasure with establishment candidates while avoiding helping elect their worst possible nightmares, as happened in Florida in 2000 with Ralph Nader helping elect George W. Bush. Joining us now is Jennifer Granholm, the former governor of Michigan and a distinguished practitioner of law and public policy at the University of California, Berkeley, the host of The War Room with Jennifer Granholm, which airs weeknights on Current TV. She was elected governor of Michigan in 2002 and in 2006 was re-elected with the largest number of votes ever cast for governor in Michigan. Her latest book is A Governor's Story, The Fight for Jobs and America's Economic Future. And she has an article at the Huffington Post, "Ohioans Won't Be Fooled by the Car Guy's Desperate Car Lies." Welcome to Background Briefing, Jennifer Granholm.
Thank you.
And your state is, well, the president and his team say that they will win it. And in fact, they said that David Axelrod said he would shave his mustache off if they didn't win it. But it's coming down to, this is becoming a key state in terms of a last minute effort on the part of Mitt Romney to sort of change history, if you will. Is it working in terms of these sort of last-minute sneak attacks, both on TV and radio, suggesting that somehow he's the champion of the American car industry and that Obama is going to outsource cars to China?
Okay, first, there's a reason he's running those ads in Michigan and in Ohio. It's because he's losing badly, and it's a Hail Mary pass to try to salvage something. But the choice of these ads was absolutely the boneheadedest move I could imagine, because people in these states know exactly what happened during the auto rescue. And he can't pull the wool over their eyes, nor can he tell them lies about the Obama administration saving the auto industry, which is causing cars now to be made in China and not in the United States. You know, the stupidity of this commercial is such that it's obviously caused the CEOs of Chrysler and of General Motors to put out statements saying that's absolutely not true. And in Chrysler's case, they're expanding employment in the United States, both in Toledo and in Detroit. So truly, it's a sign that their campaign is faltering, that he needs a new path to be able to get to 270 delegates without Ohio, but he's certainly not going to get it by taking out ads that blatantly lie when people know it.
Well, the CEO of Chrysler, his letter in the Detroit News was almost contemptuous of Romney, and the GM lashed out at him too, where their spokesman said, "We've clearly entered some parallel universe during these last few days. No amount of campaign politics at its cynical worst will diminish our record of creating jobs in the U.S. and repatriating profits back to this country." So what's good for GM is good for America, right? And they're saying that we are exemplars of capitalism. We provide jobs and repatriate profits from our successful operations abroad. Do you think it shines a light on the difference between traditional capitalism and this new kind of slash-and-burn, asset-stripping, vulture capitalism that Bain Capital and Mitt Romney represents?
That's such an interesting question. Yes, I absolutely do think that it sheds a light on the practices of certainly Mitt Romney's company, and when he says that he is a job creator, when in fact he was as we used to call it in Michigan, he's a stripper and flipper. So he would strip the companies and then flip them to make a profit. and, of course, take huge management fees in the process. That's what a lot of private equity does. Now, sometimes private equity makes that investment and the company gets healthier, and they do put it up for sale, and it lasts. But the point is that they're not making stuff. They're making paper that that transfers ownership or slims down a company, and that's the sort of new wave of Wall Street capitalism, Wall Street-only capitalism, as opposed to the traditional way where you actually make something of value and you respond to demand in the economy and you sell that stuff. But that's what the auto industry is all about. And I also think there's a new kind of public-private partnership model that the auto industry represents, where, of course, the United States government felt it was important for our nation's need to have a manufacturing sector. And so they shored up the backbone of the manufacturing sector, which is the automotive industry, a country that makes nothing. Is a weak nation, and that was the decision of the Obama administration, is that we cannot lose these middle-class jobs or the means to produce our own defense, frankly, because you remember in World War II, all of those auto factories converted quickly to be able to make the B-17 and the B-24 bombers. So bottom line is, it is a different kind of capitalism that Mitt Romney's Bain Capital and others represent. And it's not been a strategy that's been good for workers or for the country.
Again, I'm speaking with Jennifer Granholm, who is the former governor of Michigan, distinguished practitioner of law and public policy at the University of California, Berkeley, and the host of The War Room with Jennifer Granholm, which airs weeknights on Current TV. Her latest book is A Governor's Story, The Fights for Jobs and America's Economic Future. And she has an article at the Huffington Post, Ohioans Won't Be Fooled by Car Guys' Desperate Car Lies. So you mentioned Wall Street. Of course, Wall Street was almost underwater, the battery. The titans of Wall Street actually got their toes wet, and I'm wondering, they're giving all their money to Romney at this time. They were generous towards Obama in 2008, but they've clearly switched and essentially trying to elect one of their own. Romney's remarks at the Republican convention about global warming, which has now come to slap us in the face with this superstorm Sandy, he said that Obama wants to stop the earth from warming and the oceans from rising, to great laughter from the Republican delegates. And then he said, but I'll help you and your family. That kind of that sort of snide cynicism may have worked in that audience. Do you think it's working today in the face of what we've just seen?
No, I think that the evidence from Superstorm Sandy, as you call it, is evidence that these intense, ferocious climate events that are happening across the country and have continued to happen, and the number of them and their frequency and their intensity, are clearly caused by human-caused global warming and climate change, and that the idea that you would scoff at that as though that's not one of the things that's good for your family is to be able to help mitigate the effects of climate change and then help to wisely adapt to the changes that have already made. They're making decisions right now, Ian, about how they're going to rebuild Lower Manhattan. And what is that going to look like? Do you just put something up that is similar to what existed before when we've entered a new normal because we haven't done anything about climate change, and therefore do you end up paying a lot more money having to continually clean up the effects of this, or do you, yes, shore up your infrastructure, but also take steps to mitigate the damage, and I mean the damage from climate change. That means getting a national energy policy. So hopefully, there was Chris Christie was touring the shore with the president. You cannot look at these impacts, this kind of storm, which is a historic storm for them. Know that that's going to not be the worst storm you ever see because of the changes in the atmosphere, and say that that there's no cause for that, and the strong causal link between our burning of dirty energy and the weather that we are seeing has to be front and center in Congress's agenda in a second term of the Obama administration.
Again, I'm speaking with Jennifer Granholm, who's the host of The War Room with Jennifer Granholm, which airs weeknights on Current TV. She also has an article in the Huffington Post, Ohioans Won't Be Fooled by Car Guys, Desperate Car Lies. And it's not the first time that Mitt Romney has run willfully dishonest television ads. In fact, the first ad that he ran in the primaries in Iowa, he put John McCain's words in Barack Obama's mouth, and he has lied with alacrity that's quite disturbing, the ease with which he lies. And these last-minute ads in Toledo and other markets that we're talking about are just the continuation of something that's been going on from day one. And I'm just wondering, given that now Mitt Romney simply won't answer questions from the press, in the last few days they've been shouting questions at him about his stance on FEMA, which he wanted to privatize and send back to the states, and he simply refused to answer it. Is that a harbinger for what kind of a president he would be, in effect? You know, in the idea that he'd be the CEO of the United States Incorporated, and what we're witnessing now is an attempt at a leveraged buyout of USA Inc. They'll put him in as a CEO, and he'll essentially have a vice president in charge of public affairs who will release press releases, but he simply won't be accessible to anybody. I mean, this is a man who will not release his tax returns. So I have, I think, a reasonable suspicion that this is a very arrogant a man who really doesn't feel that he owes the public any explanations.
Well, I think it's more than arrogance. I think that what he wants to be able to win this office at all costs, win it without honor. No matter what, the important thing is that he get in the office, regardless of how he got there. And so he's obviously demonstrated in this campaign how he would govern if he were in the office, be through deception. It's not just flip-flopping. I think flip-flopping that everybody talks about, it's too benign. It is really a deep ambition, but ambition in the negative sense of the word, that he is willing to do anything and say anything to be elected. Fortunately, I believe so strongly that that people are smarter than that. And so when he flip-flops on almost every single subject, you talk about FEMA and the fact that the press were shouting out questions. Well, today his press secretary issued a statement saying that he's not going to cut the funding of FEMA. He believes strongly in FEMA because he knows that if he were to stand by the position that he took several months ago in the Republican primary debates, that people would be jumping all over him. It doesn't matter to him. He just is ready to say anything or do anything because it's all about just getting in office. That should scare people.
Well, if he'll say anything to close the deal, what I find extraordinary and very disturbing about it is that it does feel like ambition without purpose. Right. I mean, we know we lived through the nightmare of George W. Bush's Oedipal problems, where he wanted to prove something to his father and started a war in Iraq, which, you know, he was beguiled by the neocons that he could finish what his father didn't finish. And that, of course, ended up being the worst strategic blunder. In fact, one historian said it was the worst strategic blunder since Emperor Augustus sent his legions into Germany in 9 AD. So we've already seen. Do you understand what it's about? What makes this guy tick?
Well,
is his father? Yeah. He wants to prove something to the late George Romney, who incidentally released all of his taxes and set the standard.
Well, it's interesting you ask that. I mean, I'm no armchair psychologist, but it is an amazing you know, everybody always tries to please their parent, right? But his father did run for president, and it was the one thing his father was not able to achieve. And Mitt Romney was at an impressionable age when that happened. And Mitt Romney's dad, you know, I used to sit as governor of Michigan in the Romney building because the building was named after his dad. He was very revered and was seen as a man of honor and of selflessness, of really trying to get people to engage in volunteerism, a great champion of urban areas and of the poor. You know, the son is not the father. He's a totally different guy. And so I do think that he's trying to avenge his father's loss. That again, is from somebody who's not a psychologist. It does seem to be a bit edible in that way. But I also believe that he has just a different mindset. He has never had to. This is not his fault, but he has never had to experience trouble or trauma in terms of his lacking something. He hasn't had to fight or claw for a job or to put food on the table. It's always been part of his existence. And so when he starts a company and the MO of the company ends up being to slim down companies and to lay people off, et cetera. It just doesn't impact him in the way that it would somebody who maybe have gone through personal struggle like that. And, you know, I just think that there's a combination of both what he's done as head of Bain and how that has sort of, you know, hardened him in a way and had to, and what he has experienced growing up that leads to a candidate that I think is, well, obviously I'm partisan, but is somebody who will not be a good president.
So, Jennifer Granholm, is there, though, an element here in our polity, and in particularly in the people that Romney's appealing to, the so-called Reagan Democrats, blue-collar, mostly white men, and we know that there's demographic changes underway in America that's making a lot of white males in particular insecure about the future and susceptible to racist demagoguery. But in appealing to blue-collar people, the sort of Joe the Plumbers, you get the feeling that what might be working in Romney's favor is a kind of form of the Stockholm syndrome, where you eventually identify with your torturer. You think that the CEO, the job creator, even though part of your mind tells you that these are the guys that are laying you and your friends off, maybe this guy will save us. I mean, I know we're venturing again in...
We are venturing into dangerous territory for somebody who's a mere politician, for sure. But, I don't want to be arrogant myself into thinking that I know what's driving people to vote for or against somebody, but it is a really curious thing, and we often talk about this. Thomas Frank wrote a great book called What's the Matter with Kansas, where he was asking the question, why is it that a lot of those voters vote against their self-interest, you know, and his conclusion really is that there is really something very deep about the values side of things that motivates people. But even on that, I mean, it's just so interesting because Mitt Romney, you know, he said that he's a strong values guy in terms of, for example, a woman's right to choose. He's now, you know, he's pro-life, et cetera, which is a new position for him. But now this week, Senator Norm Coleman was sent out to say, oh, he's not going to appoint justices that would overturn Roe versus Wade, when he very much made a pledge to do that. So even on the values side, you wonder where he really is. What is this man's core? And then it gets back to your fundamental question is, so therefore, if he doesn't have a values core and he doesn't, and it's against my economic interest, why am I voting this way? That is the $24,000 question.
Well, yeah, just in closing, Jennifer Granholm, his judicial appointments advisor is Robert Bork. So I think I'd take Norm Coleman's with a grain of salt. I thank you for joining us, Jennifer Granholm. Enjoyed the conversation.
Yes, likewise. Thanks so much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Jennifer Granholm, who is the former governor of Michigan and a distinguished practitioner of law and public policy at the University of California, Berkeley, the host of The War Room with Jennifer Granholm, which airs weeknights on Current TV. She was elected governor of Michigan in 2002 and in 2006 was reelected with the largest number of votes ever cast for a governor in Michigan. Her latest book is A Governor's Story, The Fight for Jobs and America's Economic Future, and she has an article at the Huffington Post, Ohioans Won't Be Fooled by Car Guys' Desperate Car Lies. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with an insurance expert about whether or not insurance companies will take on the oil companies to stop global warming denial.
You can't hide your lying eyes, and your smile is a thin disguise. I thought
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jeffrey Stempel, who is the Doris S. and Theodore B. Lee Professor of Law at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas' William S. Boyd School of Law. He has extensive experience in insurance law and has authored books and articles on the subject, including Litigation Road, The Story of Campbell versus State Farm, and Stempel on Insurance Law. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeffrey Stempel.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And clearly, in the wake of this superstorm, Sandy, insurance is going to play a huge role. And people have, actually, a lot of people are discovering that there's a thing called a hurricane deductible, which means that unlike most deductibles, this is, could be up to 1% to 5% of the property value of your home. So if your home is worth $250,000, you could end up paying $12,500 as a deductible. That's serious sticker shock.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And you understand why insurers do it, because they want to try to soften the blow when the disaster hits. And of course, a hurricane of this magnitude presents an even bigger problem, perhaps, because of the wide geographic area. You know, the theory of insurance is that you spread the risk among differently situated people in a different geographic area. But this storm is so wide and caused so much damage throughout that anybody who's underwriting either personal or business property risks in the area, any insurer is going to be hard-pressed by this. And so insurers, you know, basically since Hurricane Andrew in 1992, which hit Miami, you know, a big one of the few hurricanes at the time that it really hit a heavily populated area. And since then, insurers have tried to protect themselves with these sorts of things. But most policyholders are blissfully and now not so blissfully unaware of it until disaster strikes.
So the costs of this are being estimated between $5 and $10 billion. That comes from EKCAT, right? That's the insurance loss projection firm. But there's a distinction here, which I want to figure out from you, between insured value and economic value. So that means that there are two different figures. If $10 billion insurers lost, but there could be up to $50 billion in other losses. So what's the difference there?
And two things. You can sometimes have things that are insured and things that are uninsured because they're specifically excluded, you know, a particular piece of property or something that isn't renewed, or you may have people who don't have high enough limits. But more to the point of your question, certain things that we value as an economic matter are not necessarily physically tangible and thus are not typically insured under the typical property policy. So an example for that would be if my home gets knocked over, the cost of rebuilding the home will be covered, subject to possible depreciation if I don't have a replacement cost policy. But the disruption that it causes me, whether I'm it depends on the policy, but frequently certain sorts of dislocation and lost time and the sweat equity every homeowner or every business person has to put in is typically not paid for. And if you don't buy it specifically, you may not have what's called business interruption loss. And that is, unfortunately, it's a coverage that costs more, and as a result, many policyholders elect not to get it or don't buy too much of it. And when you have a situation where the infrastructure is down and the transit is down and the commerce is down for weeks or months, you could have a situation where there are a lot of true economic losses suffered by particularly a business, but they may not be insured losses.
And again, this shouldn't be surprising that there's a pattern developing here. You mentioned the first one, Andrew, but since then, of course, Katrina, then Irene, and now Sandy. The big German reinsurance company, Munich Re, it had this prescient report that was distributed by Travelers. And it argued that the U.S., because of its densely populated coasts and vast territory, is unique in being prone to disproportionately from weather-related events. Quoting, nowhere in the world is the rising number of natural catastrophes more evident than in North America. Since 1980, the U.S. has suffered more than $1 trillion in weather-related damage and just more than $500 billion in insured losses. So tell us about the role of the of these reinsurance giants and the fact that they are really waking up to global warming.
And I should give Munich Re credit. I've seen reports of theirs going back 6, 7, 8 years, so they've been ahead of the curve. And I must say, at the risk of sounding politically incorrect during an election season, the European insurers have been quicker to recognize this and are often a little more sensitive to emerging issues. The American carriers tend to be, by the book, more conservative, slower to adapt. So, and now, fortunately, reinsurance is important, and reinsurance has been referred to as even a silent regulator, because some insurers really can't do much business unless they can get the reinsurance. So Munich Re, Swiss Re, Lloyd's of London, those are all major reinsurance markets. And now that they have awakened, hopefully that'll have a positive impact because they recognize that the danger this poses. I should add that Europe is not scot-free. Some very huge losses have taken place during winter storms in northern and western Europe. But as the report noted, the U.S. is particularly vulnerable. And then, of course, at the risk of again wading into a political thicket, the U.S. has been slow to really come to terms with what certainly every credible scientist now recognizes as a problem of climate change and increasingly rising temperatures that create less than completely predictable havoc, other than that we can predict that there will be more of these disasters unless there's some sort of an attempt to control the carbon fuels. And as we saw in New York, it's probably time for regions of the country that don't think of themselves as in a national or natural disaster belt to begin to build up to code standards. The most obvious example being the crane that we've seen dangling in New York that was built to withstand up to 90-mile-an-hour winds. But my understanding is the state of the art will get you a crane that can withstand 140 or 150-mile-an-hour winds, but they don't want to spend that kind of money outside of the Gulf area. Well, I think it's now clear that any time you're anywhere, you may need to have to spend that kind of money to make sure that cranes and buildings and infrastructure is appropriately supported going forward. But the reinsurers, we hope, will have an impact by kind of waking everybody up. And if nothing else, we can try to get coverages that are more tailored to things. We can get better building standards, and we can have a commensurate premium. No one likes to pay high insurance premiums, but better that the insurance be there and that it be solvent and able to respond than to have a situation where we have these huge gaps in coverage like we're seeing consistently after situations like Irene and Katrina and now Sandy.
Again, I'm speaking with Jeffrey Stempel, who is professor of law at the University of Nevada School of Law, and he has extensive experience in insurance law and has authored the books Litigation Road, The Story of Campbell versus State Farm, and Stempel on Insurance Law. So what is then the difference between a reinsurance company like Munich Re and insurance? What's the role that reinsurance plays?
And reinsurance is basically insurance for insurers. So if I'm the Acme Insurance Company, I will frequently purchase reinsurance, and reinsurance can be done on what's called a facultative basis for a particular risk, or there can be what's called a treaty, which is a reinsurance agreement across a number of risks that a particular insurer has. And essentially, there are also different formats where the reinsurance may share pro rata the loss that an insurer suffers, or it may step in after there's a certain point of attachment that's been breached. So it's a way for the insurers to basically protect themselves against the contingency that there'll be something they haven't properly calculated for or predicted that will put their own funds under stress. In normal times, insurers are basically invisible banks. They have large accumulations of money, and typically know if it's just normal activity, you don't have a run on the bank. But after a large disaster of this magnitude, same with an earthquake, you can have sort of what's the insurance equivalent of a run on the bank. And if insurers don't have proper reinsurance in place, they better be awfully big and awfully solvent and have awfully deep pockets. So that's why companies like Munich Re and Swiss Re and the Lloyd's syndicates, are an important backstop, and they're the source of where you would go to get the really big dollars that will be put in play when you have a disaster like this.
We saw what happened with AIG, which was the largest insurance company here in the United States, and they seemed to have decided to get off into other risky territory rather than sticking to what they know, and the taxpayer had to bail them out.
And that's really a true failure of regulation, but also too much greed and maybe too much faddishness. The AIG insurers were all, you know, quite healthy, as one insurance regulator described them at a meeting I was at, basically bricks of gold sunk in the mud being all the financial speculation that AIG had undergone. But the actual insuring operation was pretty solid, and some of that is because they know what they're doing. Some of that is because they weren't always the easiest company to collect from when claims were made, and so they had managed that part of the business pretty well. But to the extent that you commingle insurance with other financial services and become more speculative, that, in my view at least, undermines the triad of security and solvency and predictable risk spreading that you want an insurance company to be able to accomplish. You know, if you will, sort of there's a social purpose as well as an economic purpose. So that's, in my view, one of the reasons you can justify some of the favorable regulations insurers have. For example, they're exempt from antitrust laws, and they are considered to be contracts that are affected with the public interest. But if you're not careful, and if the insurer behaves like a day derivative trader, we saw that can create some real havoc with the markets and undermine the otherwise very solvent insurance part of the operation.
So, Jeffrey Stemple, let's talk about then the politics of the situation here and the extent to which, as you mentioned earlier, these reinsurance giants like Munich Re, who see the writing on the wall vis-a-vis global warming, and they're the ones that put up the real money, in effect. But you're saying that in the United States they're not as aware, or perhaps they're politically blind because it is a political issue. In fact, the current candidate for the Republican Party and the entire Republican Party is pretty much on record as in denial of global warming. So, and I mean, since insurance here in the United States is a state-regulated matter, what will happen then when these big reinsurance giants like Munich Re and others are saying to the regulators, we have got to raise premiums because global warming is happening and we're going to incur further crippling losses? And the insurance regulator, who's a political appointee, say in a red state, says, well, I don't know what you're worried about. You know, global warming is a fraud.
Well, and we have the same problem, unfortunately, potentially in a blue state where the insurance regulator wants to run for potentially higher office or be perceived as a consumer advocate. And, of course, the easy way to do that is say, I kept premiums low. And then when the disaster strikes, if there are problems of solvency later, that regulator has been replaced by another regulator. So we have a real principal agent consistency problem. But I see two different potential scenarios here, and I'm not sure which will win out. I think the good scenario, if you will, is that insurers could play a role like they've done historically. I think the classic example is what happened in the early part of the 20th century, where insurers created an underwriter's laboratory. It was created by underwriters or to serve the underwriting of the insurance industry to try to move for more safe electronic devices, and so we now started to have UL-approved plugs and cords and lamps and other devices over the years, and as a result, there was a real downturn in the number of home fires and sparks and electrocutions, and so the insurance industry really did play a very positive role in safety and society at that point, and you could see potentially a similar thing happening here, because it's certainly an industry with considerable clout. And it could lobby not only to say we need better premiums and we need to provide more comprehensive coverage so there aren't these gaps, but it could also be effective in lobbying for sounder building regulations, better coastline treatment, maybe even as something as simple as what was suggested in the New York Times over the weekend, getting the oysters back in the bays around New York as a natural break from the storm surge. You could see that happening. On the other hand, there are some very powerful interest groups that are aligned basically, as you suggested, in denial, or at least in terms of short-term economic maximization, and they're fighting any kind of regulation tooth and nail. The energy industry in particular, I guess, is probably the number one culprit. And in that battle among well-heeled industries, I'm not sure who will win. One problem I think that the insurance industry has may be, and I don't claim to be an insider, but I think there's a little discontinuity of goals. The property and casualty insurers really feel the problems related to natural disaster and climate change. And those are the folks who do the property insurance and the homeowners insurance and so on, because when they have a loss, it hits big, it hits one at once, there are a lot of claims to pay. Other insurers spread their risk over time and have other ways of managing the risk that make them less vulnerable. For example, a liability insurer, someone who defends the policyholder if they're in an auto accident, or a business if they're sued in a tort claim, that claim can stretch over years. It usually gets paid back in inflated dollars. It can be settled sometimes for less than its full value. In the meantime, the insurance company has the money in the bank. There isn't the same run-on-the-bank problem you get in the immediate aftermath of the big destruction of a hurricane. And it's my view, at least, that that part of the industry has been considerably less concerned about getting involved in the sort of things that will reduce the exposure for their property and casualty insurance brethren. Now, sometimes you have all these companies under one corporate arm and so on, but I think there's a significant difference in the level of urgency that different parts of the insurance industry feel. If you could get the entire industry at the level of concern of, say, a Munich Re, that would be a pretty powerful lobbying force, and it might even be enough to stand up to big oil. But you know, all bets are off, and at the micro level, it even matters who's in charge of a congressional committee or who's in the governor's office, and maybe maybe it even matters whether it's a swing state or not, and all that makes it very hard to do what I would regard as sort of the rational risk management course of action, because it's inevitably going to get mired in the politics and some of the personal agendas that some of these actors are going to have.
Well, just in closing, Jeffrey Stemple, Governor Cuomo of New York said on Tuesday, we have a new reality when it comes to these weather patterns. We have an old infrastructure and we have old systems, and that is not a good combination. So in terms of this battle between big oil and coal versus the insurance companies about the reality of global warming, you would think, though, that given the financialization of our economy, which is about at 50%, and the power of Wall Street, they all live there. The battery is exactly where they live, and that's what was underwater. So these financial titans have actually gotten their toes wet.
And maybe this will be the thing that sort of brings it home to a part of the, if you will, the power structure that has not been in the forefront on this issue. And it's a great point. And, you know, again, depending on one's whether one's a Keynesian or a different sort of economist, one could argue that there would be some significant economic benefit to doing the things that we probably should be doing anyhow in order to make the country more resilient against these sort of episodic disasters.
Well, Jeffrey Stemple, I thank you for joining us.
You're welcome, Ian. Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Jeffrey Stemple, who is the Doris S. and Theodore B. Lee Professor of Law at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas' William S. Boyd School of Law. He has extensive experience in insurance law and has authored books and articles on the subject, including Litigation Road, The Story of Campbell versus State Farm, and Stemple on Insurance Law. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about how you can vote for third parties and feel good about it and not have a repeat of Florida 2000.
In this sacred land, it has seen many hands. It has wealth and gold, yet it is fragile and old. And now the greedy souls just don't care to know all the changes it will confront. So you know some people, they just won't understand. No, they just won't understand these things. Thank you for your message, but I don't understand.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jeff Cohen, who's a media critic and lecturer and founding director of the Park Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College, where he's a professor of journalism. His latest book is Cable News Confidential, My Misadventures in Corporate Media. Cohen founded the Media Watch Group FAIR, and he's the co-founder of RootsAction.org. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeff Cohen.
Great to be with you.
And RootsAction.org are offering up a way for people to have what they're advocating is a safe state, swing state voting strategy to signal displeasure with establishment candidates while avoiding the effects of helping to elect the less preferred candidate, which in effect is what happened in Florida in 2000, where you had an environmentalist, Ralph Nader, running against another environmentalist, Al Gore, and those that voted for Nader ended up helping elect an incredible anti-environmentalist who ended up being the most disastrous president in American history, George W. Bush. So obviously people want to avoid that. Tell us the mechanics of your new strategy here.
Yeah, I think the idea is, as you say, to avoid that kind of an issue, but also encourage progressives where it's safe to express their displeasure with Obama policies that were in some ways continuations of George W. Bush's policies, who I won't argue with you might have been the most disastrous president in American history, or certainly one of them. So the plan is simple. There are a dozen swing states, battleground states, close states. Some of them are virtual ties at this moment as we speak. Ohio, Florida, Virginia, New Hampshire, Colorado, Iowa, Nevada, Michigan. They're virtual ties. And so we're encouraging people, even if you have misgivings about Obama, even if you're upset with Obama because he talks about clean coal and safe nukes and fracking, and he's extended some of the bad civil liberties policies of Bush, and he's expanded the military in some ways, cut it back in others, but it's the biggest military budget ever. If you're upset with Obama because you're progressive, because you care about peace and justice and the environment and equal rights, but you live in one of these dozen close states, we're encouraging you to go vote against the worst candidate, the right-wing Romney-Ryan ticket, because you want to prevent an even worse regime from taking power in January. But if you live in one of the 38 safe states, unswing states, lopsided states, where we know that Romney's way ahead or we know that Obama's way ahead, there we're encouraging voters. And by the way, this proposal is endorsed by people like Daniel Ellsberg and Cornel West and Francis Fox Piven and Noam Chomsky and Hightower and Ehrenreich, Marjorie Cohn. The idea is in those states where it's safe, go forth and express your progressive displeasure with the Obama regime by voting for a Jill Stein of the Green Party, or voting for a Rocky Anderson of the Justice Party, or voting for peace and freedom. There, it's fine in those states. Try to register a half a million, a million votes that think that Obama's too corporate, too conservative, too militaristic. Basically, we're taking advantage of our 18th century archaic voting system, which doesn't have a national election. It's state by state, winner take all. And we're telling people in safe states, yes, vote third party, progressive. But in close states, swing states, battleground states, if you have relatives that live in those states and they're on the border, because they think Obama's been disappointing or bad or bad on civil liberties, encourage those people in the close states to defeat the even worse regime. We know Romney Ryan on almost every issue that I've mentioned will be even worse than Obama.
Again, I'm speaking with Jeff Cohen, a media critic and lecturer and founding director of the Park Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College, where he's a professor of journalism. He is the author of Cable News Confidential, My Misadventures in Corporate Media, and he founded the media watch group FAIR, and he's the co-founder of RootsAction.org. He, along with Daniel Ellsberg, Cornel West, Francis Fox Piven, Barbara Ehrenreich, Marjorie Cohen, Jim Hightower, and Norman Sullivan, have signed this petition to create a system where people can do what they're describing as safe state, swing state voting strategy to signal displeasure with establishment candidates while avoiding the effect of helping elect the worst possible candidate. In this case, it would be Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan, who would surely, I think, close the deal for corporate America. Yep. He is, after all, an exemplar of the 1%. And since he's got Robert Bork making his judicial appointments, I think you could safely say that would be the end of women's rights.
And keep in mind that RootsAction.org, which has issued this call for progressive strategic voting, we've been critical of Obama week after week after week. And one of the reasons we've been critical of him is a coziness with Wall Street, that Obama's chief of staff originally was Rahm Emanuel, a Wall Streeter, then he was replaced by William Daley, another Wall Streeter, et cetera. That so much of the economic team for Obama was Wall Street. Well, you know what the reality is? As bad as we believe Obama has been on protecting Wall Street over Main Street, Romney is getting, according to the latest figures, for every dollar that Wall Street is giving to Obama, they're giving Romney $4, $5, or $6. So, it's hard to find an issue. As dissatisfied and angry as many of us are with the Obama administration, it's hard to find an issue that Romney Ryan will not be worse on, whether it's warmongering around Iran, you name it, reproductive rights, Supreme Court appointments. So, again, this is an effort to take advantage of our archaic, outdated system. In those safe states like California, yes, vote for Jill Stein of the Green Party if that floats your boat. Express a progressive protest against Obama. But get your friends and relatives who live in the dozen swing states to get out there and defeat the Romney ticket, which is propelled. I listen to talk radio. I founded FAIR. You know, it's being propelled by a lot of racism, and you don't want to say yes to that. You want to stop Romney Ryan in the dozen swing states while expressing displeasure in the safe states. And I should point out that in Europe, much of Europe where they have advanced voting systems of proportional representation in parliament, all you have to do is get your party a couple percentage points or 3 or 5 percentage points, and they become part of parliament. And in the case of the Green Party in Germany, they become part of the administration sometimes. Well, we don't have that. So if we're trying to put together like a center-left coalition, which you can do in Europe just by running your own party and then forcing the corporate centrist party to come to the left and form a coalition with you, well, we don't have that here. So the only way to have something like a center-left electoral strategy is to say vote left in the 40 safe states, including California, but vote against Romney by voting for Obama if you're in Ohio, Florida, Virginia, New Hampshire, Colorado, Iowa, Michigan, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Nevada.
Again, the states that are the critical swing states are Colorado, Florida, Iowa, Michigan, Missouri, Nevada, New Hampshire, New Mexico, North Carolina, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and Wisconsin.
I've looked at the latest polls right before I got on the phone with you, Ian, and there are about seven of those states that are basically ties. They're too close to call. They're 2.5% or less dividing the two major parties. In those states, Dan Ellsberg, Noam Chomsky, and the rest of us believe it's a mistake not to get out there and block the right-wing Republicans from winning this election. In those close states, you've got to get out and vote for Obama and oppose Romney. Even if you've criticized Obama, as we have at RootsAction.org, week after week after week, this is the time to act strategically, try to get a big vote for the left where you can in safe states, but block Romney by voting Obama in the dozen swing states. And it's all on our website at RootsAction.org.
And Jeff, if you needed any more evidence, not that one does, about what a disastrous presidency the Romney-Ryan would be, if you just go back and in the current context of what just happened, and you're on the East Coast, you've just lived through this massive storm. If you recall what happened in the Republican convention down in Florida, where to a rapt applause, Romney said, "Obama wants to stop the earth from warming and the oceans from rising."
And people laughed.
And they laughed. And he said, "But I will help you and your family." Well, you know, the laugh is a little bitter now, I think, given the reality of what's happened. And
well, it's truly shocking. You know, we all have our concerns that Obama doesn't talk about climate change, that Obama's opened up some offshore drilling, that Obama supports fracking, that Obama, up until about a year or so, he was still using the phrase clean coal. As bad as Obama might be on these environmental issues, and I believe he's been pretty bad, Romney will be far worse. Romney will immediately push Keystone through. Romney is always blasting Obama for not doing enough offshore drilling, for not doing enough for fracking our earth in this unsafe way for gas.
He supported, by the way, by the oil and gas money, almost
no
inclusive.
Doubt. No
I
doubt.
Mean,
again, it's like
Chevron just gave the biggest donation a corporation has given in this race. They just gave $2.5 million to Romney and Ryan.
And I think you're bringing up a good point, because when I've been discussing with people in swing states what they should do, should they just pretend it's not happening and pretend that there's no difference between Obama and Romney on all these issues where we believe Obama is too corporate, and he is. As you say, Ian, the oil and gas industry is giving almost all of their money to Romney. Wall Street is giving more money to Romney by 4, 5, or 6 to 1 over Obama. And Obama got a lot of that money in 2007 and 8. But most of it's now, almost all of it is now going to Romney. So on these issues where we believe that Obama has put forward a corporate agenda, and he often has, it will be far worse under Romney, and we have it in our power. You know, there are millions of progressives that listen to the stations, Ian, that your program is on. There's millions of people that know that the right-wing Republicans are a threat, and that the Democrats are too corporate and too militaristic as well. For those millions of people, those progressives, we have it in our power to make sure in those swing states that Romney does not win. And we also have it in our power in those safe states to register a protest vote against Obama. To me, it's a win-win. It's a way of making your presidential vote count, whether you live in a swing state or a safe state. It means you do something different in a swing state. You vote Obama than you would in a safe state like California, New York, or Texas, where you vote a Jill Stein or a progressive third party. But the strategy remains the same. We defeat the right wing while trying to build up a left protest vote against Obama.
So just in closing, Jeff Cohen, obviously because of the duopoly and our 18th century system of voting where the Electoral College still really rules, there's a couple of things to point out here. One is that if this is such a tight race where Obama may end up winning the Electoral College but be behind in the popular vote, won't you be adding to his deficit in the popular vote?
Yes, and that's fine by me. The key is not to apologize for, lie about what the Obama regime has done these last 4 years. The point is to prevent an even worse right-wing regime from winning, from taking power and taking over the White House. But if Obama is denied a popular vote because a million or so people have voted for candidates to his left, that's the kind of campaign news I want to hear on the day after the election. Frankly, I would love to see 5 million people in safe states voting against Obama. I mean, remember, the problem in 2000 wasn't that the vote wasn't big enough for the center or the left. The problem was that in Florida, it was close enough for the Bush forces to steal. And if there had been this kind of strategy in 2000, where in states like Massachusetts and California in Texas, progressive groups and unions had endorsed Nader and said, look, we want to get a big vote for Nader here because it won't play any role in the Bush v. Gore issue. But in Florida and Ohio and Pennsylvania, you know, Nader's not campaigning or Nader's not even going to be on the ballot. We could have worked out a center-left strategy in 2000 where the center and left would have defeated the right by millions of votes and Gore would have beaten Bush and, you know, Nader would have got the 5% and the millions of dollars in matching funds for the Green Party. I mean, the reality is that we have to take advantage of our bogus system and put together a center-left strategy on our own, and it involves, I don't care if Obama comes up with less of the popular vote, especially if that's because a lot of people voted for Jill Stein of the Green Party or Rocky Anderson in safe states. That would be a great outcome as far as I'm concerned.
It wouldn't be the outcome that the Republicans would advertise, though.
No.
They would say, they are so invested in their hatred of Obama, and they've already invented his illegitimacy as a Kenyan interloper without a birth certificate who's a Muslim. I mean, you can imagine this country will go through an absolute conniption.
I don't think it's within our I don't think that should be a number one concern for progressive voters. We know that the right wing is going to use any propaganda advantage. It's going to be hard even for those propagandists to pretend that somehow Obama not winning a popular vote but keeping the White House is somehow worse than when George Bush took the White House after the Florida theft when he lost the popular vote by millions of votes.
660,000.
Yeah, he wasn't even close to 50% of the electorate in 2000. So, I mean, I think that would be an incredible feat even for the Republican Party to somehow try to delegitimize Obama because he didn't win the popular vote. The reality is that progressive voters have something to think about, and I think we at RootsAction.org have given a strategy that makes a lot of sense.
Well, Jeff Cohen, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Jeff Cohen, who's a media critic and lecturer and founding director of the Park Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College, where he's a professor of journalism. His latest book is Cable News Confidential, My Misadventures in Corporate Media. He founded the Media Watch group FAIR and is the co-founder of RootsAction.org. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting and streaming at ianmasters.com, where you can contact me. And the conversation continues at Facebook/IanMastersMedia. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. And the things that he had seen. But quiet.
the headlines written down.